You're listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental.
TMZ, oh my goodness.
I think he's the philosopher of football.
I'd like to have some more derbies.
Absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory. We're trying to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
From New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental from the AT&T MLS Studios in Midtown Manhattan. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer, David Goss, Bobby Warshaw. You are inspiring me, Bobby. I felt like I went through months, weeks maybe more accurately, of just not having it. Off the intro, I didn't have my New York, New York, and now with you semi-mocking me and or...
Neither of us are paying attention to you.
Oh.
We're just looking at LAFC lineups.
Oh, my bad.
You were in a good flow, though.
Yeah, I was. I felt great about that.
Yeah. I was just worried you were going to try and set it up for us to react to you, and you were going to get a whole lot of nothing, and then Bobby was going to say nonsense, so I figured I'd nip that one in the bud.
Okay, you did nip that right in the bud.
We had a
big show for you. You've ruined my momentum off the top, but we have a great lineup here. John Arnold is going to be by to talk Mexico. Why are we talking Mexico? Well, because the U.S. are playing them again after that Gold Cup final that we lost. But the team is a little bit more complete. There are some young faces there. Sergiño Dest, one of them. Paxton Pomykal, another. Miles Robinson. Of course, we talked to Greg Berhalter on this podcast last week. Go back and listen to that if you haven't already.
Great
we will
interview.
Take you all the way through that game. We're going to talk Nations League, which the two of us are really excited about. Let's go. Bobby is...
I'll be excited when you guys tell me the rules.
Got you. Less excited, but we're going to figure that out for him. And
I
Canada.
Really hope Bobby doesn't dive into that because I feel like we're at some point we're going to get lost.
I know. We will. But Canada, they have to know the rules because they have to win basically everything in order to get to the hex, which if you're Canada, you feel is unfair. And if you're Dave, you might feel is
stop
is proper.
To me.
Yeah. Okay. We'll get to that. And of course, a truncated week 27 coming up. Just 5 games in Major League Soccer. We will talk about the big topics. Maxi Morales, about the sign a contract extension. He is massively, massively underrated. We will rewind to the Union's big win against Atlanta and kind of put that in context and maybe also put LAFC's loss to Minnesota United in context. And then, of course, we will hit your mail. Let's see, what's the best thing in the mailbag? Most disappointing teams?
The reason we've been looking this stuff up is someone was asking best expansion draft picks in MLS history, and I was looking up ones that came to my mind, which Bobby was confused why I'd looked those people up because Bobby has less of a breath of MLS knowledge than me, and
right.
So therefore he didn't understand what's happening.
Bobby doesn't like when other people touch him, but now Bobby is going, was that like a purple nurple attempt
right
through this incredible Adidas jersey that Dave is wearing?
Eric Rometty wear this and was like, I think I could pull that off. What's up, Eric? He didn't respond to me. So then I had to go figure out how to find it.
Right.
And I found it, and then I bought it.
And if you're watching on YouTube, you can tell that this is actually my profile put onto an Adidas jersey. Maybe not the same bushy eyebrows. But I applaud you, Dave. I really do applaud you because, if we get it right in there, Because I bought an Adidas shirt that Mark Anthony Kay wore, and I have yet to actually put that shirt on because I am too terrified of the roasting that I will get from both all of you and the comments section. So if you're watching on YouTube, you got that imagery right there. Let's just talk Sergiño Dest to start. This game, US-Mexico, Friday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern. It's on FS1. They're playing it at MetLife in the old Meadowlands area.
It is the Meadowlands.
The swamps of New Jersey, nice. Basically. All the cattails.
East Rutherford, New Jersey.
You can see New York City, but you are not in New York City. So he's got a situation going here because he is a dual national, and you know how soccer Twitter freaks out about those and MLS Reddit and everybody else. Sergiño Dest confirmed in camp to Brian Shireta and other reporters that were there that the Dutch have called him up to the U23 team. He is eligible for the Netherlands through his mother, for the U.S. through his father. He said he appreciates the U.S. opportunity, but he is keeping his options open. Cue like the tier 5 panic meter.
Yeah.
For everybody out there who monitors these things. Yeah. I like that. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Quote, I'm happy for this opportunity. I'm happy that I'm here right now, but I don't know for the future yet, said Dest. You guys will see what happens when the time comes. He doesn't know if he would play next month in Nations League, which would be a cap-tying game. If he does want to play for the Dutch, he would have to file that one-time switch because he has played for the U.S. youth teams in official competitions. Of course, we saw him at the U20 World Cup. He did say Greg Berhalter reached out before this camp, 2 weeks before, and he told him, I want to have you for the September camp, and I would like for you to be on this U.S. team. Dest says he was, quote, a little bit surprised, but he felt valued. I like to play for the U.S., and I like the opportunity. So before we get to this game, what we want to see collectively, what players have something to prove, whether it's Sargent or Giassi up top, how should Serginho Dest be used? Berhalter had a lot of really... it was noteworthy, his praise, I would say, in the interview that he had with us. He's been watching. He respects the level. Obviously, what Serginho has done in preseason into the early parts with Ajax, who, by the way, were a semifinalist in the UEFA Champions League, has really caught his eye.
Well, the basic question is, you're asking, Andrew, should he start? Like what you're asking.
I am asking that.
So the reasons he should start, I'll go with two. One is that he's been playing for Ajax. Right, when you play for Ajax, he's already played Champions League games, he's played games in the Dutch League, and he's looked good. Number two is you want him to feel valued. And we're going to get into the conversation on the idea of recruiting and getting players to play for your country when they have other choices. But those, to me, are the two main reasons that he's been playing at a high level, he looks good, and you want to make him feel
good. There's also a third reason, which is you don't have a starter. It's not like you're saying...
right back or left back?
Either one.
That's fair.
I mean, you can't say to me that Reggie Cannon is the lockdown starter at right back.
No, for sure.
Right? So that's the other one is like, it's not like you're saying, hey, Josie, take a seat, right? Mm-hmm. Or Steve Cherundolo, take a seat.
Right.
For this kid, he's basically as legitimate at that position right now as anyone else is for the U.S.
That's fair.
I would say if I was starting a team tomorrow in a big game, I would start Reggie Cannon over him, but not by far.
There's two counters to that. One is that he's new to the system, and Greg Berhalter has said, we value continuity. And we'll probably have that conversation, too, because you have to have it on the national team. But Greg Berhalter wants guys who understand how to play with the other 10 on the field. But two is, if you watch his games, both in the Champions League with Ajax and in their league games, they have all of the ball, right? He is it's a attacking, defending drill, right? It's really hard to measure how good he is overall as a player, where his game is at. And if you did watch him in the U20s, he struggled defensively. This will be a game where the U.S. primarily defends for large chunks. And while he is a very good player with a tremendous skill set going forward, there's still a big question. If you watch his games regularly for Ajax, how well he can defend.
So would you go to him and say, listen, I think you fit the Uruguay game better. I want to give you a little bit more time in the camp. I'll start you then.
No, I would play him against Mexico for sure.
But if you're saying possession, they'll have more against Uruguay than Mexico.
For me, the make him feel valued part, make him feel like he's a starter. Going into those games when you can cap tie him in October, make him feel like the best player on the team and that the country's hopes rely on him.
That feels a tad premature to me.
Yeah, it feels aggressive.
Just going to say that off the top. But I'm going to ask you, right back or left back, since you said you would start him. Serginho says that he is equally comfortable at both, which I don't know for sure. I've only seen him play right back with Ajax, and I believe only right back for the U20s. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know, but if he says it, I'm willing to believe that he knows his game much better than I will. And both those positions that you said are wide open.
Yeah.
Like if he's on the left, maybe he gets to combine with Christian Pulisic, which I had my fan service 11 that I put in my column here, and that's like drool worthy. For supporters out there who are looking at these young players and saying, oh my God, how will they fit together? Like Pulisic and Dest in possession in the attacking phase is incredible. But then on the right side, he could be, I would say, that Tyler Adams type that we were talking about. Maybe not defensively, but like midfield fullback hybrid. But he almost feels perfect for that role.
Yeah, I agree with that. But he could also be that on both sides. There's no reason that has to come from the right
That's
side.
Fine.
The idea was Tyler Adams was more comfortable on that side. Dest isn't. So I agree with you. I want to see if that's something Greg Berhalter believes in, which is for some reason at the international game, it's hard for teams to prepare for it, or he believes that it opens up the game in some way to bring that fullback in and use them as a central midfielder. I think Dest on the ball, his ability, because of probably the system he came through and his skill set, he's probably high up in the pool, all positions, not just fullbacks, ability on the ball, ability to pass, ability to take it under pressure and break line. So I would like to see him play as that way, but I'd like to see it from the left side, because if he's saying he's as comfortable on both sides, we haven't had a left back in the United States for 50 years. Why would you not at least try him out there? Because you're saying, here's a pool of six or seven guys at right back that I might be okay with, and that Reggie Cannon, DeAndre Yedlin,
Nick Lima,
Julian Araujo, Nick Lima, one of those guys is going to be an international level starter over the next 10 years.
And if, look, but if it's right back, and if the Tyler Adams experiment is still in Greg Berhalter's mind, and he's still saying, hey, when Tyler's okay, when that adductor's fine, when he's back playing for Leipzig, he would go to right back for us. Well, if Dest is good enough and he shows it against a Mexico or to Uruguay and you end up locking him down in Nations League, then maybe you're imagining a future in which he's the right back and Adams gets to move back in the middle, and all of a sudden now it's an Adams at that defensive midfield spot, if that is where Greg sees him. That feels natural to me. Again, I'm not Greg Berhalter.
We have to interject, though, because what you're talking about, the famous inverted right back system, they're not going to use against Mexico.
Sure, sure.
They didn't use it against Chile. There are two very distinct styles that Greg Berhalter needs to work on with the ball against the majority of CONCACAF teams. Then those other, whatever it is, 30% of games against Mexico, against Germany, against Uruguay, when they played against Chile.
Well, Uruguay, because Uruguay is going to be like Chile. They're going to sit behind the ball.
No, Chile dominated that first 60 minutes until
sure.
Berhalter
Sorry,
adjusted.
I meant Ecuador.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fair. But this is going to be a two banks of four, the 4-2-2-2, as Greg calls it, with the two center midfielders, the two wingers a little bit higher, and the two strikers, pretty much the same way the first 60 minutes against Mexico was in the Gold Cup final. So this is not the outside back tucking in. Maybe it happens twice a game, but you should not pick your outside backs with that in mind.
Okay. I was imagining a bigger future where that could maybe work, but it's a good point from you. Let's go to the sort of hand-wringing side of this, because how he plays, what he does, that's Greg Berhalter's purview. He will make that decision, and I'm sure that Sergiño Dest has been communicated to. I don't think he comes into this camp and sits down and is like, I don't know if I'm going to play. I don't know where I might play. I don't know what my role in this team will be. Like, Berhalter's job...
Probably got a binder already.
Yeah, his job is to communicate that, and based on our interview and what we know about Greg, I think he's done that. Now, the bigger question is, maybe should Sergiño Dest's decision, which he has to make at some point, not right now...
Well, not necessarily.
Maybe by next month.
Oh, unless he never gets... All right, sorry.
Yeah.
League Cup or Nations Cup games start. Nation League.
Yeah, Nations League. CONCACAF Nations League, Bobby. Just trying to help you out here. Just trying to get you on board the, you know, it's a...
But it
we're at the beginning
October.
Of the roller yes. coaster, man.
Well, no, it starts this week. The U.S.'s right. first game is...
We'll explain in a bit. Here's the question. Should Dest's decision be a huge deal to U.S. supporters, to the American soccer program? How should we put this in context? What if Sergiño Dest decides, actually, I'm going to go with the Dutch U23s. Actually, I'm going to decide that the country in which I grew up, the country in which I play my club soccer, the country that is ultimately half of my identity, or perhaps even more because he's lived there, we don't know, that's Sergiño Dest territory, he can decide that, is actually what I want to do. And I'm so appreciative of the U.S., the opportunities I was given at the U20s, the opportunities I'm getting in this window, the praise from Greg Berhalter, but ultimately it's better for me to do that. How should we put this decision in context? Would it be a calamity? Would it be a catastrophe? Would the sky be falling, as I imagine the internet would put it, if he decided the U.S. was not his future? How do you think about this?
You go first, David.
My short answer would be no. It should not be falling. It should not change people's perception. The long answer would be, well, you'd start with what are the reasons? And if the reasons are, well, I never was communicated with, I never felt that I was part of the camp, people specifically pushed me out. Like, if there are negative reasons, then, and there's something structurally wrong with U.S. soccer, that is something to react to. I would say, in general, yes, he's played for Ajax for a few weeks, but we can name the list of U.S. players that have played for top X club when they first broke through for X weeks and then ended up playing in the championship for the rest of their career, or in Major League Soccer, or not even playing soccer, right? So I wouldn't personally go with Sergiño Dest as the future of the U.S. national team, and if he's not a part of the team, we have no future, but if he is, we're going to win the World Cup. I don't put him on that level, and I don't know that many young players are on that level, so I wouldn't react that way. And on the side of their ability to recruit him or get him to join, it's going to be tough with everyone. I think it's individual with everyone, but one of the hang-wringing things is people don't feel like Latinx players are included in the U.S. pool properly. They don't feel like they are treated in the way that makes them want to be a part of the program. Sergiño Dest deciding to play for the U.S. national team or not isn't a part of that conversation. So I think there are multiple dual national conversations happening at the same time, and you probably are going to end up in a situation where they all get poured on this one scenario, and I don't know that that's correct.
I don't think it's fair either. I don't think it would be a disaster. I think it would be hugely disappointing because Sergiño Dest has been in a U.S. shirt in a World Cup. The U-20 World Cup has performed well despite some of the defensive issues that he might have had there, Bobby, because he has what appears to be the beginnings of a really potentially incredible career, despite the fact that we know that odds aren't always with young players. Like, things happen. Injuries, form, coaching changes, a big signing into Ajax, whatever it might be, things happen. Things can change really quickly. But I think that the kid has to be given the space to make the decision. Like, whatever he identifies with is what he should go with. Whatever he thinks has the best opportunity for his future. And we've heard a lot of kids recently say this outright. Instead of going with the whole cliched, like, I feel more American or I feel more Dutch. Like, we know that that is outdated, that that is ultimately unfair. Like, he grew up split between two cultures. He grew up outside the U.S. Like, let him be who he is. And if he has better opportunities with the Netherlands, then let him take that. Because let's be honest, historically, the Netherlands are a better national team program than are the U.S. And he's in Ajax every single day. He's with a bunch of Dutch youth internationals. Those are his boys.
Internationals. Yeah,
those are his guys. And if they're putting on the full court press and saying, hey, Serginho, man, we think you're really good.
DeLette's texting him. DeJong's texting
him.
Yeah,
come on. Come play with us, man. Come play with us. We think you can impact this team. If their coaches are putting on that full court press with him, then maybe he makes that choice. And we shouldn't take that as, oh, my God, we screwed this up. We should take that as Serginho Dest had to make a personal decision that was extremely difficult for him. And in this case, we were on the wrong end of it. But it does go back to what you said, which is people want to know that we are doing everything as a program to make that happen. And Berhalter said, not my job to contact 15-year-olds. And I agree with Greg Berhalter in that sense. It is, I think, Greg Berhalter's job.
Champions League starters, yes.
To communicate with potential players in your first team pool that could impact your team. That is the job of whether it's Berhalter or his assistants or a staff member or whoever.
Or Ernie Stewart, yeah, the GM, whatever.
Which who should have a really good opportunity to make this recruitment pitch given his background. So, look, whatever he does, I'm not gonna fault the kid. It's context. Maybe we can look at the program and say there's an issue here. I still think that having a quote-unquote recruiting coordinator a la college basketball or college football is not a bad idea. You'll pay somebody $75,000 to comment on Instagram stories.
Nice.
So, like, text the kid that you had a good game. To
everyone,
like,
can email us if they want that job.
To run the flag up the pole to Greg Berhalter or Ernie Stewart if you feel like there's a little bit of push and pull, or you feel like a kid isn't feeling like he's valued or his family's not, or you just need to reach out and say, hey, we're watching you. You did great against Groningen this weekend, or whatever it is. But, like, we put so much on individual players, and I understand why we do it, but I think give the kid some space, and I think the odds are he is going to choose the U.S. I think those are the odds, because he said he got the opportunities of the youth teams. He does have to make a huge life-changing decision by filing that one-time switch if he is to do it.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true. I would just say the three of us here are diehard USA fans. It's the only country any of us could play for. And if the Dutch asked us, we'd try and figure it out if we could play for them. Like, there's nothing wrong losing a player to the Dutch national team, right? They're one of the great programs. And well, it would be the same as if Spain or Germany or Italy or France asked, and you were like, oh, man, we lost this dual national. All right, Bobby, are you disagreeing right now?
I just don't know how I feel. Yes, okay. I disagree, but I don't know how to articulate it. Okay. I just think you guys are undervaluing the power of recruiting and making somebody feel valued.
I just said that I think we should have recruiting coordinators. I literally think that we should have, like, the college basketball assistant coach who's just like the cool guy who everybody likes, who communicates well, who gets along with families, who can be the conduit who just says, like, you know, I don't know if we have budget, you know, I'm sure U.S. soccer would be like, hey, we're doing a lot of this, and if they are fair,
and based on what we know, it's a lot of what Thomas Rongen did. Right, Thomas Rongen was going out and finding anyone anywhere that had a passport and connecting with them when they were younger before they broke through to be like, hey, we've been around. But, Bobby, once again, I'm the University of Nevada. I'm recruiting a top quarterback. I have done everything right. And Alabama comes in and says, come join our program. It doesn't matter. The U.S. stands where it stands, and there's nothing wrong with that. Giuseppe Rossi gets an offer to play for Italy. He's going to play for Italy. It's Italy.
But we see University of Nevada's in both basketball. I'm over this conversation. Nice. Everyone else in American soccer is having this. They, like, have
Is University of Nevada good at stuff? Did I pick a bad school?
No, there's just schools that break into the top 10 all the time. I just don't have the energy to make that argument right now because everyone else is. And I'm just, you know, I'm not energized by this conversation.
Hey, look, and Serginho Dest is in camp right now. He has an opportunity to bond with young guys in a similar position that he is, on the brink of Champions League or playing in Champions League. Weston McKennie is there. Christian Pulisic is there. There are guys that he can identify with. He, you know, according to Paxton Pomykal, that U20 team was super tight. They were boys. He could look around and say, you know what, this is my team. This is where I feel comfortable, and I hope he does. But I just, I get a little bit nervous when we start putting so much on 19-year-old kids' shoulders who ought to do whatever it is that's best for them, whatever it is that's best for them and their families. They should do that.
I just want to say that Weeby makes that comment 12 minutes after we did the segment talking about whether how much this matters.
Well, so I don't know that your reaction right now is valid. I think that the conversation, though, has moved away from what you're saying. I don't think people are hand-wringing about what Sergiño Dest will do. I think what has changed is the hand-wringing now is, how is U.S. soccer handling these situations? I might be wrong, and it might just be our conversations, right? From where we were at 12 years ago, talking about dual Mexican internationals, dual whatevers, where you're like, I hope they play for the U.S. and they don't, and then people would get upset about it. I think the conversation has shifted. Now the issue is, to Bobby's point, what is U.S. soccer doing? Because it feels like they're losing more than they're winning.
But who have we lost? I guess that's my question. Who have we lost?
Jonathan Gonzalez obviously is a big one.
That's a big clear one.
And I think that's a big one. There's other
Giuseppe Rossi, Nevin Subotic.
Yeah, that's back in it. That's a while ago, but yes.
Yeah, okay.
Nevin's like 30 years old. He would still be starting for the national team.
Well, he had injuries.
Maybe.
Subotic was a big one.
But it's a fair point. And I think both of those got dissected and got broken down. And I also want to make one correction, I think. It's probably not Greg's job. It's probably Ernie's job.
Yeah, I would agree.
He's creating the structure. And then within that is with all those jobs. Like, that's the structure. It's his job.
Yeah.
Who's the player for Chivas Guadalajara?
Brizuela was the one I was going to bring up, which is like, it was a player that would be better for the U.S. than he was for Mexico because it was something we needed more. And it was, it sometimes feels like, oh, Giuseppe Rossi's good. Everyone wants him. We want him too. And why are we not 3 years ahead of that? Which is, hey, connect with players before they break through so that they feel like you actually care. And it's not just like, now you're good, now we want you.
I just want to say, I very much want to move on from this conversation. But going back to your original point about the individuals, like, if this national team program in the U.S. had Giuseppe Rossi at striker and Nevin Subotic, a starter in a Champions League final at center back, this is an entirely different program. So the idea that...
Although Giuseppe Rossi would have played 12 games based on his injuries, but yes.
Right. Well, that's another...
Okay.
Injuries and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, just the quality of player. I mean, then the U.S. national team is an entirely different tier. So every single player, especially with Dest potential, matters a ton.
We also left out one name, which is Pulisic.
Oh,
Pulisic had an option. Yeah, yeah. And he's playing for the U.S. And he's just got sold to Chelsea for an amount of money that Croatia would put him in their team.
Yeah,
so we...
And Croatia, by the way, was in a World Cup final. And that's so...
Tim Weah also.
Yeah.
Tim Weah, I think, could play for France and Liberia. So...
Hey, man, it's, you know, build a culture, build an environment that players want to be in. I think that that's happening right now. I can't, off the top of my head, like I said, come up with some huge list of losses for the U.S., but I understand why people really care about this topic. It's just like, it feels a lot to me like recruiting in college sports, where you have like the message boards that are just, everything is so important, and that 4-star linebacker from Louisiana, we better get him or everything's going downhill. Well,
Bobby, how's the Stanford men's soccer recruiting boards?
No, I'm just curious. So moving forward, I will transition the show right now, Andrew.
Okay.
How do we think the U.S. should play against Mexico?
I don't know, because I wrote that one for you. So I'm going to flip it right back around and ask you that.
I didn't know it would be that easy to transition the show.
Is.
If I knew it was that easy,
super
David,
easy.
I would have done that way more often.
Yeah, man, just get your hooks in it and that's it.
How should the United States play? Ooh. So there seem to be, if they want to win, right, the best chance of winning is going with the same thing the United States has done for 20 years, right? 4-4-2, two strikers, try and catch Mexico on the break, give Mexico the ball, but they're going to make their mistakes, and the U.S. has Pulisic and guys who can really get on the break and be dangerous. I've been saying this for years. At some point, you need to make yourself a passing culture, right? At some point, you need to let guys fail passing out of the back. And I hate the idea that we continue to say it's a process. And even when the U.S. loses, so many people say, oh, it's getting closer. We do it with CONCACAF Champions League. We do it with USA-Mexico games. And like, how many times can we say that MLS teams in the U.S. are getting closer and they still lose, and we say, okay, maybe we're not getting closer. But I do think that there's parts of it that the ways that MLS and U.S. teams have gotten closer aren't actually in the ways that make you closer, right? Soccer is a game of passing and just general control on the ball. And the United States has not really tried to do that. Even though Jurgen Klinsmann said he was going to try, he didn't. And I don't blame Bob Bradley for not. U.S. soccer is in a totally different place. So if I'm Greg Berhalter, I say, we are going to pass out of the back no matter what. We are going to dictate this game. There is no plan of going in the 4-4-2, two banks of four, block of 10, restricting space. We're going to go in. We're going to be the aggressor. Be damned. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, go ahead. You just did it.
Be damned if we lose, right? But we're going to take a definitive step forward.
So I actually like that. Because why come in and say you're going to play different? And we asked him, why is now the time? Why is now the time to be brave? And he said, well, I think we have to take that step. Like, if you're going to do it, you just got to do it. So I like that. And if you're going to do it, you better do it against the teams that you'd have to do it against. It's like, okay, do it against Guatemala. Cool. We knew you could do it. Or at least that's been done before. Do it against Mexico. What's the best team to do it? It's not necessarily the best players we have. What's the best team to do it? I took a crack at guessing Greg's lineup, and I'll be happy if I get 5 out of 11 right. I put mine out there, what I wanted to see. I put out a fan service 11, but I don't really know what the best group to do that is, Bobby. So I wonder if you've mulled that over, if you've thought, okay, if we are going to play this way, if we're going to be brave in this manner and we're going to do it against Mexico and we may pay for it, mm-hmm. or we may not. Maybe this is the time where we don't.
Can I start with the team? Brooks and Long at center back? Even though both would prefer to play left, I think they're the two best passers of this group.
Okay.
Are you disagreeing?
I would still probably play Long at left back and Dest on the right because I don't rate Cannon as highly as other people, and just acknowledge that.
Oh, you Yedlin... play Long at fullback.
Yes,
I really don't hate that. Yeah. Like, and I feel like now that I look at my lineup that has Tim Ream there because I wanted somebody who was a little bit more, you know, behind Pulisic, and we know that the U.S. is going to be under pressure at times, who's a little bit more able to defend 24/7 when it comes to it. Now I want to put Long at left back, but then who do you partner with Brooks? Because Brooks
Ream.
Is back in.
I would play Ream. Play Ream at right center back, even though he's left footed.
Really?
Over Zimmerman and Robinson.
I would, yeah. If you want to pass, man, like, listen, I like Walker Zimmerman as a player a lot. I like Miles Robinson as a player a lot. Tim Ream is better at facing pressure and breaking lines. It's that simple. He was the best. When he was at New York Red Bulls, he was the best, if not any nationality, at least the best domestic passing center back the league has seen in
was
my
that
memory.
Over 10 years ago or just 10 years ago? 07, 08, 09?
Yeah, I mean, playing for Fulham in the championship makes it hard to continue to maintain your passing.
Okay. Also, the pool has changed.
Yeah. It's not going to be
right. So is Walker Zimmerman? Are you telling
no,
me?
The thing I like about Zimmerman, though, is he can step into midfield with the ball at his foot if teams don't pressure high and they play off. Which is one of the things I thought he did well in the January camp, which was when the game shifted to the right and Lima pushed in, he would continue to take that ball past the midfield line into the other team to make them react and allow something to happen.
So let's imagine a back line. I think we all agree. Zach Steffen and Net. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Is it a universal agreement there? Let's imagine one that is, in Bobby's mind, that is Long, Brooks, Ream / Walker Zimmerman, mm-hmm. and then right back. Who are you going with? Who would you go
I would
with?
Do Dest.
You're going Dest
because
there.
Because Dest is the best one on right. the ball. And again, recruit, man. I appreciate what you're saying, and I wouldn't be whatever the kid wants he can do, but I still believe you put on the full court press, you make him feel like he is an undoubted starter in the future of the nation's team going forward, going into the meaningful games.
Right, I respect it. Right. I would say Walker Zimmerman at that position next to him or Aaron Long because the defensive issues,
right.
And if it's him and Ream right there and I'm Mexico, I'm like, I know where I'm going,
yeah.
Which they may already be thinking. Central
I'm
midfield.
Excited about this.
D-mid. Alfredo Morales, who hasn't been in the team since 2016, but is a Bundesliga starter or two Bundesliga.
But we're talking about not...
Or Will Trapp.
But this example is the if your team is going to pass.
Correct.
So I don't know necessarily it has to be one of those two. Bobby, who would you put?
At defensive midfield.
Well, yes. Who are your three center mids? Let's call it
this
that,
is the
right?
hardest one.
Yeah.
What Berhalter is going to do at defensive mid is undoubtedly the hardest question. Does he go back to Will Trapp? Like, haven't we seen what's there before? I wouldn't be shocked. But if you don't go Will Trapp, you really have to change what you're doing. You have to go away from the single pivot, the 2 8 and 10s. And yes, as we talked about in the extra time interview last week, they've already changed the rotations a little bit. But even still, you would really have to redefine that role. Weston McKennie is the name that people point to. When I watch him with Schalke, I don't see the traits of a defensive midfielder, right? He's not comfortable 360 degrees.
As a single pivot.
as a single as that player. Yeah. Their most recent game, they did a weird system where the other defensive midfielder is rotating out, and it was just him. Like, we got to see what it would look like with Weston McKennie as a single pivot. He just isn't comfortable receiving the ball 360 degrees. He likes to drive forward. He doesn't want to sit. Weston McKennie should probably be used somewhere in the team. Some people say he should undoubtedly be used in the team. I just wouldn't do it defensive midfield. So at that point, it's Will Trapp, Jackson Euler, Alfredo Morales.
And who is it going to be? This is your go-for-it lineup right now. I know it's hard. What's your three-man midfield?
But also change it, Bobby. If this is what you're doing, why is it a single pivot? That's my point. It wouldn't be. I would play Yule and Pomacol next to each other. Or I'd play Roldan and Yule next to each other. And you could play McKennie higher. But my point is, if this is what you're saying, which is let's control possession, then you want two players in that area that are going to be high retention ball players, as well as guys who are going to connect short passes and help move the game around. So you don't need to have a single pivot there. A guy like Will Trapp who can hit the big switch and then have two guys in front of them that are going to be more aggressive because you're not pressing.
That's interesting.
Uh-oh. We're stuck.
I know.
This show's about to run. Yeah.
Whoa. Producer Anders in here saying, hey, guys, we got to move on. We have to talk about.
Can I throw one thing out there, which is I would love to see Sargent start, and I think it's fine if it's not at center forward because I thought he played comfortably there for Wolfsburg this weekend on the left side.
Werder Bremen.
Sorry, yeah, Werder Bremen.
Those green teams in Germany.
So I think that – I just think he should be – based on the group they have, I think he should be a starter, whether it's out wide or at center forward.
I would say that I think Sebastian Legette should be in this team if we're going back to sort of the single pivot, what we've seen before, because I think he's one of the few players that is truly comfortable in that 360, like you were saying, Bobby. And if it's McKennie and it's Trapp, you need that guy in there, I think, with his ability to receive the ball in tight areas and get the ball somehow wide. That's where the chance creation comes from if it's not the big switch.
What do we say? It's going to be Trapp, guys. What are we talking about?
That's what I put in my column. That's what I put in my column. How about up top? Pulisic on the left? Do we think he's going to do that? Put him on the wing? Yay or nay?
Yes.
Yes, I think he's going to go Zardes up top, and I hope he starts Sargent against Uruguay in St. Louis.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. I hope he starts both games, quite honestly.
Yeah, I mean, look, I kind of do too, but I think that probably having the baseline of Jesse Zardes, who I know, get out your pitchforks, light your torches for me right now, but the rest of the team knows him well, and against Mexico, where I don't think we'll have much of the ball, maybe good to be direct, which is why I think Jordan Morris will be on the right. Yep.
I agree with that. Hey, two little things that I'd like to see, just the really refined details, is when building out of the back, you have to feel okay driving the ball 60 yards into your striker. That is perfectly fine to be a possession team that doesn't mind breaking lines in the air and getting the ball into your striker, bypassing the other team's press, and either winning the second ball or playing off the striker. It's perfectly fine to do that. The second thing is when the U.S. presses, their strikers need to block the lanes into, whether it's Alvarez or Dos Santos or Guardado, whoever is playing center mid for Mexico. That is what hurt the U.S. against Mexico last time. Pulisic and Josie did not block those passing lanes so the center midfielders could get the ball too easily. We talked to Berhalter about the man-to-man press they're doing. The first thing you need to do when you pressure the ball as a striker is block the easy passing lane into the defensive midfielders for the team. So keep an eye on those two things.
Love that you brought up Mexico and some names there. Of course, this game Friday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern on FS1. To give us the El Tri perspective, we've got John Arnold on the line. He's a CONCACAF correspondent at Goal.com, one of our favorite people in the world, and a noted tire aficionado. John, welcome to Extra Time.
Oh, glad to be here, guys.
Oh, we're glad to have you.
Is this the number one tire-based podcast that you do?
Talking Tires is my higher-rated show, but this is the one I enjoy more.
Gotcha. We appreciate the compliment, and so does Continental. Let's get right to it. We're talking Mexico, and I want to know how Tata Martino is going to approach this game on Friday in the swamps of New Jersey.
Yeah, it's interesting because my suspicion, and this is just a suspicion for now, we're making an effort to see if we can turn it into a reported story, but the suspicion is that Martino might put more of his focus on the second game of this FIFA date, this friendly window, and take the Argentina game a little more seriously. You know, he made waves a couple weeks ago when he was doing the press for that game in San Antonio, when he said that Mexico, for him, is still sort of a second-tier national team. And in the first tier, he put Argentina. Now, it's been a long time since Argentina's won a major championship, the Copa America, in the early 90s. But I think Martino, just by virtue of being Argentine, the relationships that he has there, the fact that he managed that team and got so close to winning multiple enormous major tournament titles, still has Argentina as sort of a team that sticks out to him, even without Messi, even during a friendly window. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see a Mexico team that's a little it's not his best team. I think he might be saving them for Argentina. I could be wrong. But you have to remember that even if he does put out a lesser team, you know, a team that maybe isn't his best 11, you're still probably seeing names like World Cup veterans, Mexico's all-time leading scorer, Chicharito, Miguel Layún, I think, is part of that unit. Diego Reyes, who just returned to Tigres from Europe, I think he's part of that unit. Midfield is absolutely stacked. Jonathan Dos Santos, who was maybe the best player in that Gold Cup final, scored the winning goal. I think he's part of that unit. So you look at this depth that Mexico has, and it's difficult to see them sort of having a really noticeable drop in quality between, I guess if you want to call it the A team and the B team. So I think no matter what team Martino puts out there on Friday, it's going to be a pretty strong one and a pretty difficult one to play against.
A better team than we saw in the Gold Cup final, I think, with those names included, that's for sure. But it kind of gets me wondering here, as you say, that Tata looks at Argentina and says that that's the priority. U.S. national team fans have got to have that little pit in their stomach and say, hold on, hold on, I thought it was us in Mexico. I thought this was the epic rivalry. What is the perspective right now for El Tri on U.S.-Mexico? Has it gone down a notch?
I think it probably has, just because in the games that have mattered, you know, there's that friendly last year, the Lainez-Miazga friendly, the 1-0 that was in Nashville that the U.S. won. But, you know, that was post-World Cup friendly. The games that have mattered have been taken by Mexico in recent history. Mexico fans have always had, sometimes fairly, sometimes not, sort of a superiority complex over CONCACAF rivals, specifically the United States. And so far, in the Tata Martino era and in the Juan Carlos Osorio era, they were able to back it up with victories in World Cup qualifiers, with the fact that they qualified for the World Cup in the United States didn't, and then once again sort of reinforcing that belief, I think, in the Gold Cup final with, you know, while we know that the U.S. wasn't necessarily at full strength either, a Mexico team that was missing so many important players, Irving Lozano's injury, some of the guys we talked about earlier because of personal absences or just not wanting to be called up as part of the team, the whole Carlos Vela situation, which you guys have covered a lot on your program before. By winning that game with a understrength roster, I think Mexico fans and maybe even some of the officials, players, people actually in the national team setup have kind of said, well, listen, maybe this isn't our most important game, but I think that it's going to come back, right? U.S.-Mexico is never going to go away. This is the 70th meeting between these two teams. As we see more meaningful games between these two teams, whether it's Nations League, whether it's qualification returning, whether it's in the Gold Cup once again, I think that sort of fire, that passion will be back. It's just right now where we find ourselves ahead of this game. I definitely think there's a little bit of an apathy from the Mexico side toward this rivalry.
You mentioned Tata Martino's comments about Argentina. There aren't a lot of Mexico national team managers that could probably get away with saying that. And I think about the animosity at times between the media and sometimes the general public and the Mexican national team manager over the last 20, 30 years.
It seems very stressful.
But it doesn't seem like Tata Martino's experienced that. What's it been like, his relationship with the press?
No, it's interesting. He gets away with that kind of comment, and he also gets away with the fact that as far as media availability, there's been absolutely nothing. I think the U.S. has made several players available to chat with the press so people can write articles, do television hits, just do the job of the media after every single training since they arrived. Mexico had an almost full team starting Monday, the first time that the media will hear from anyone involved in camp, aside from a simple hello at the hotel or in the bus, you know, on the way from the bus to the training field, is Thursday, the day before the game, when Tata Martino gives his press conference. So I don't think many managers could get away with that if they hadn't had the results that Martino has. He's yet to lose a single game with Mexico. The only game he didn't win outright, or he's won every game, however you want to count the Costa Rica quarterfinal that went to extra time, and then penalties, they came out in top of that one as well. So the results have been what Martino has been able to kind of rely on, and I think he also just has the reputation, you know, winning MLS Cup with Atlanta helps, but just having coached Argentina, having coached Barcelona, the success he had with Paraguay, I think he arrives with a much more sort of freedom, much more leeway than Juan Carlos Osorio did. It was Osorio's first national team job, and Martino's a more conventional manager than Osorio is in the first place. So the honeymoon period, we're definitely still in it. At some point, it'll come to an end, but I think he's kind of buying himself a lot of, I don't know about time, because I think, you know, if he's going to get fired, he's going to get fired, but he's definitely kind of banking up goodwill right now with all these results. We'll see how long it lasts.
Yeah, we will. And if the U.S. win, it might be over, that honeymoon for Tata Martino. CONCACAF correspondent at goal.com. One of our favorites here, John Arnold. You can follow him on Twitter. Arnold, comma, write that out, C-O-M-M-A, John, J-O-N. John, thanks, man. Appreciate you.
My pleasure, guys. Always fun.
All right, thanks to John for sharing his insight with us. Follow him on Twitter, his coverage at goal.com. He covers Liga MX, he covers El Tri, he covers all any number of things in CONCACAF extremely well, and we love him. Let's talk Nations League, and you are, as you're a voice of the Nations League. Can
yeah,
I say
for
that?
Sure. No,
you're
you
a
can't.
Voice of the Open Cup? Nations League is here! It's yeah. beautiful, it's wonderful, and I love it, and we're going to explain it to Bobby. It is also going to help determine 2021 Gold Cup team. So there are three pots here, which nations have qualified for: League A, League B, and League C. In League A, you have the obvious Mexico, U.S., Costa Rica, Honduras, Panama, Canada, and then it's like Haiti, TNT, Martinique, Cuba, Curacao, and Bermuda. Jamaica got left back in B because in qualification, they didn't get the job done. El Salvador is also there, which is important for Canada's perspective. The way this works is that there are groups within each, and you play home and away. And then, to determine the Nations League champion, the top teams in Group A are going to move on into a four-team sort of like semifinal to final run. They'll play that. The winner of that obviously gets all sorts of plaudits, and you can applaud. Also, the top teams in Group A automatically qualify for the 2021 Gold Cup, as do the second-place teams. The third-place teams, these are three-team groups, are going to have to wait, and they may qualify a different route. So to get to the Gold Cup, if you're in Group B, and I got to like figure this out here, the winners of each four groups in League B will go directly to 2021. And then the second place finishers in B and the first place finishers down in C are going to play home and away next March. Whoever wins that will go on to a home and away with the third place finishers in League A. And the winner of that will go to the Gold Cup. And that's how you get to the 2021 Gold Cup. Yeah, that's the long and the short of it, Bobby. But the real sell here is that there are meaningful games that matter, that are competitive, that are not friendlies against teams that are pretty evenly matched. Is that right?
I'm just going to say this.
Right.
I have no idea what you just said.
I know. Just, it's itemlessoccer.com. Go read it.
The qualifying part makes it confusing. But the second part, Weeby said, is the entire point, which is for a lot of these teams, not only do they not get to play a ton of meaningful games because they're out of World Cup qualifying 3.5 years before the World Cup starts. They get two games for Gold Cup qualifying and that's it. They also play the same teams over and over again because they don't have enough money to go travel for friendlies.
Right.
And so you just see the same Caribbean teams play each other, the same UNCAF teams play each other over and over again, and then Canada goes and plays like Morocco in Spain in front of no one. And that's kind of
or
what
like
you end up with.
In Qatar, Saudi Arabia, right. Or whatever those
now,
friendlies are.
Now you've got a situation where Bermuda is going to get to sell out their stadium to host Panama in a meaningful game in 2019 when that would not even be part of anything. The qualifying for the last Gold Cup, which is what qualified people for, as well as doubled as qualifying for this, we're also big crowds, big environments, meaningful games for national team programs to be able to like start to set a stone and say, hey, you know, we're going to bring in a young group here and this is what we're building for.
Look at Guyana, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Bermuda.
Bermuda is
the
first
time.
One.
Look at Curacao. Mm. Look at some of these countries that got momentum, that got opportunities that just never would have even been on the radar.
And you have two things. You have one for a team, a program like Bermuda to say, okay, like this is a path forward, how we're going to get better. And a team like Curacao to say, hey, for people who don't live here or people who play overseas or who have never played for us, here's a meaningful game worth coming back for and being a part of our program, which keeps people connected more than the I think Guadeloupe had it like 10 years back where they got everyone to come for one Gold Cup. They played well, and then everyone retired or went away.
Stefan Avery, baby. Get that CONCACAF trivia going. Love it. Love it. Canada, though, has a big task in front of them. They're in a group with the U.S. and Cuba. Basically, all the top teams in Group A, they're not playing in this, I'm all thrown off because Bobby's over here just rubbing his face.
I still don't know what's going on.
He's just like, oh my God, I don't get it. Anyway, the top teams in Group A are not playing in this international break. So you're talking about the U.S., Mexico, Costa Rica, and Honduras. They'll wait for October and November when the other windows are to play their games. But Canada has back-to-back against Cuba. And Canada, according to John Herdman, the head coach, basically has to be perfect in order to get into the hex, because to get into the hex you have to be top six in the FIFA rankings. That's on ELO. It's math, it's hard, I'm not going to go into that, but they got to win, like maybe even win the whole thing, like get past the US, finish atop the group, get through the semis and win the final, he says. Otherwise nothing is guaranteed. And to do it, they got to beat, quote, teams that we haven't beat in a long time. And in Canada, they're not so happy about this.
Which I don't understand.
It seems, because they feel like it's maybe a little unfair, because right now they're eighth, and Panama and El Salvador are in front of them.
Yeah.
And
didn't Panama just go to a World Cup?
That's fair.
Panama deserve? You could argue about El Salvador, and then you get down to, are the rankings the best way to do this? But the reality of it is Canada hasn't been to a World Cup since 1986, I believe. The way the last structure was set up was really hard for Canada to get in, and Canada has not beaten those teams, as John Herdman said. So if you go back to the old structure, they would have had to beat Dominica and Belize to get into the group to play Mexico and Honduras and El Salvador. So now you got to beat Cuba and the U.S. Otherwise, you have to beat Honduras and Mexico. They're the same quality of teams. You have to win those games to get to the next level, and then you still have to qualify for the World Cup. So I understand a little bit saying, well, I wish we could have known a little earlier. That part I get. But the quality of team you have to beat, the amount of times you have to beat them in meaningful games, remains the same.
I would rather take the SAT than a quiz on how this stuff works right now.
Stanford education,
I wonder,
baby.
Yeah, that is it. Yeah, no tests, no homework. Come to Stanford. Final games for Canada are October 15th in Toronto against the U.S. and November 15th in the U.S. They have two against Cuba, who they beat 7-0 in the Gold Cup. And, of course, they lost to Haiti 3-2. So, by the way, again, if you want to be one of those teams that feels like you deserve, like, hey, you want to be better in the rankings? Go to the Gold Cup final.
Yeah.
Win the games before that, because these are all based on previous results.
And beat Haiti when you're up two.
That's
but I will say this. I'm doing one of the Canada games, so if you're in the U.S. and watch that game, I think you'll hear my voice, but I'm not sure. You have to be excited if you're Canada.
Yes.
Like, even just delving back into it, because I was in the summer, we talked about a little with the death stuff, like the culture around the national team, blah, blah, blah. David and Davies and Laren and Osorio, they seem so excited to be a part of this group, especially when you hear what Jonathan David has to say.
Yeah.
And then I would kill to have Marc-Anthony Kay in the U.S. national team pool right now. Like, I wish that conversation about ball retention and who you had was with Marc-Anthony Kay in it. And so there are question marks along the back line, but there's a lot of young players that if one or two hit, you're good. And then they've called in a few, like Adam Strath, back in of like veteran guys who are sort of dual internationals, haven't really been around, where it's like, just don't be a traffic cone. And it's already an improvement over what Godinho did in Gold Cup. And there's at least a pathway forward for the national team.
There is. Look, Canada, I get that there may be a little consternation with the way this works.
Get pumped up, Canada.
We love you. We're not saying we don't. We want you to be there. We want you to be in the hex. But just win these games. I don't know. The problem is, except the ones against the U.S., it's hard. Anyway, Nations League starts, and you know, we'll figure it out, Bobby. We'll help you out. We'll go get the whiteboard going, and we'll map this whole thing out. It's at MLSsoccer.com and CONCACAF's website as well. MLS Week 27, however, will also be happening in the midst of all this. There are five games. There are a lot of international absences. I was reading something earlier this week about, you know, back in the days of MLS where you'd be like, oh, you know, handful of players are gone for international breaks, and now it's like half the league. And that's a good thing, by the way, though I do agree that there needs to be some sort of middle ground, some better solution found for observing these, because I think it would make the quality of the competition in MLS better, as well as on the international front. But that's a whole conversation for a different day. The schedule makers have a hard job. Seattle in particular are gutted. 10 players out for international duty. Gonzalo Pineda is an assistant coach, and he's gone for international duty with the US U-23s, which is super cool, by the way. So that is what it is. Big points on the line. I think Portland Sporting Kansas City, that's a huge game. Seattle on the road in Colorado, big points there. Orlando just trying to stay alive with LAFC in town. Cincinnati just trying to ruin Toronto FC's season. And then New England and NYCFC in the East. And I want to talk NYCFC because Max Morales is reportedly up for a contract extension. They are chatting about it. And I just don't think we give him enough credit. I think he's one of the best 10s in the league. He is certainly one of the best chance creators in the league by Opta numbers. If you go look, last year he was number one in chances created from open play. He's right there this year. He leads in assists. His season so far this year, 7 goals, 18 assists, which leads Major League Soccer. That would be an MVP season 10 years ago. That would, like, and he's not even close to being done. He could finish conceivably with 10 and 25. This guy's legit.
Let's do the ranking. Let's rank the top 10s in Major League Soccer right now.
Okay. Who's above? While you think about that, I just want to throw out there.
Go for it.
While you were just talking, Bobby Warshaw Googled a Warshaw article.
Nice.
He typed into Google Warshaw, and then something else.
To be fair, I don't remember much of what I wrote either.
I do a top five list before and after every year.
Okay.
Every
I'm just
position.
Throwing out
so,
there.
And I just wanted to see, Maxi Morales did not make it at the start of the year. Coming into the season, the top five number 10s on my list were Nico Ladero, PT Martinez, Darwin Quintero, Lucho Acosta, Diego Valeri. I had Maxi as number six.
I feel like Darwin.
No, you would have had Darwin preseason.
Really?
You would have. Andrew Wiebe.
But he's more of a second forward. I don't think of him as a straight-up chance creation.
You would have had Darwin Quintero on that list.
I want to dispute that, but I don't know that I can.
The one that would be questionable is Lucho Acosta, but you would have had Lucharoo.
You're right about that. Pity Martinez, I would have hoped that I would have pumped the brakes on.
I would not have.
Oh.
I feel okay with that selection.
So who's at least in the conversation?
And now, right, Lucho's out.
Yeah, Lucho's out.
Darwin's out. Petey's out.
Petey's out, yeah.
Valeri's up there. You could probably put the Valeri-Sebastian Blanco combination, but I would probably even put Maxi above Ladero. Ladero's different, right? And he has more burden to carry with Seattle. Mm-hmm. He is that entire the whole team is the engine. Maxi is one or two this year.
Does LA have a 10? LAFC?
No.
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 No. So you're not counting Vela in that. So he's out. You don't count Carlos Hill?
Yeah, Hill's in the top five, but he's not as good as Maxi. Pozuelo had a five-game stretch, but not anymore.
But the other half of this
conversation... Kaku's not there.
But the other half of this conversation is you're pushing him higher up the rankings because the position is less useful.
It's a little different.
Now you're getting deep, and I like that.
But Maxi's he's kind of a second forward at times, too. He's not always traditional sort of like,
I'm just saying that's like saying, well, this guy's a top five center in the NBA. Why is he not noticed? And it's like, well, because no one uses centers anymore. That's all I'm saying. Sorry. Continue.
No, I love that. The evolution of the 10 is super interesting.
A top five chance creating predominantly midfielder.
Ooh.
So you're taking him out of that central role. And now you're adding in.
What?
Come on. You can't understand that? You're always thinking abstract.
What?
He's basically saying add Vela back in this conversation.
I am.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ooh, even the wingers. I mean.
Yeah.
Ooh.
I think he's top
Nacho
five.
Piatti,
Blanco.
Take Piatti at the list. He hasn't played.
Alessandrini, Elise were in the five wingers to start the year.
I think he's, Blanco, this is my point. Is if you look at his actual production, if you look at the performance of NYCFC, the reliance on him to make everybody around him better, which he absolutely has. Hebert gets talked about. Castellanos gets talked about. Tinnerholm just signed a contract extension. We've talked about their kind of wing play. Where's Ismael Tajiri Shradi? But like, Maxi Morales, he's the basis of this, and what a signing he was, because he's not at like Schweinsteiger or Lampard or Pirlo money. Like, he was basically unknown to Major League Soccer fans coming from Liga MX, and he's been the foundation of their team.
Yeah, so one of the things in terms of Hebert getting talked about more is Maxi Morales has played an off-the-charts amount of minutes this year, so he is the baseline for NYCFC. When you talk about NYCFC, you say, well, what can make them better, and it's whether Hebert's in the team or not, which is not to his fault. But on the flip side of that, I would say the amount of minutes he's played, he will be 33 before they kick off next season. How many years of a contract do you want to give a guy like that at that position? Stature for him? Like, how much is he going to...
You're saying put up a statue.
Yeah, I can't even get my words. How much is he going to bang around in an MLS midfield at 34, 35 years old?
You said
the
same thing about Ozzie Alonso last year, guys. 33 is not the same thing anymore.
Yeah, but also Ozzie plays a different role. I think Max Morales does a great job avoiding contact.
Also,
Ozzie's
not...
Sure, that's my point.
But he's not a DP. You're not giving him a DP contract.
Okay. Yeah, you got to give Maxi one. Anyway, we love Max Morales. Congratulations to him. I hope he gets his money. One more thing from this weekend, and I want to talk LAFC because we didn't get to it because of Labor Day and we didn't work.
Should I set
the
alarm off again?
Go for it. Oh, your other one was so much better. That was like a whale sound. That was awful. That was horrid.
Hey, that one's for Kalen, the Orcas in Seattle.
Can I ask if LAFC are vulnerable at all post Minnesota United loss? I had a bunch of NYCFC and Atlanta fans sending me the numbers from like the last 15 games or 13 games or whatever cherry picked number of games they came up with where the records are basically identical. And they're saying, yeah, well, LAFC was dominant and best ever first half of the year, but they're basically even with us the rest of the time. And all that matters is the end of the year. So is there any sense a vulnerability, Bobby, to LAFC after that game? No Carlos Vela. That's the huge caveat. That's the asterisk that has to be in like 72-point font. Anything to that?
For sure there's vulnerability. I mean, breaking down 10 players behind the ball in their own half is really hard in soccer. It's as simple as that, especially when a team is as committed as Minnesota were. So yeah, whenever you put 10 players behind the ball, Andrew, you and I could go get 10 players right now, put them on the top of the 18 and hold LAFC off the board for some amount of time. Right? You see in training, people don't like in training, teams often do 10v5 and the 10 struggle to score on five. It's hard to break down players at the top of their own box. So there's definitely a concern, especially in a single elimination game. It's going to be hard for LAFC to break down these teams. Who else did they lose? They lost to Chicago, who did the same? Or they drew against Chicago?
Portland at home.
Portland at home.
Which was a bit of that, yeah.
When the Sounders were down a man, they still didn't score, right? When teams, Vancouver, when teams are in their own half with numbers, it's hard to break down. Even LAFC, who I still maintain is the best team in league history, struggles with it. It's a fact of soccer. Manchester City, Barcelona, the best teams of our memory, all struggle with it.
Heard of them.
They're good.
They're better at it than LAFC. Right? But it's not a new thing for a team to be bad at that.
So get Carlos Vela in that training room and get that hamstring good to go for the rest of the season and make sure he's good in the playoffs. Because if he's there, all of a sudden that it's really hard to break down Timman behind the ball goes to it's kind of hard or it's like medium hard or not that hard at all anymore. And all of a sudden you've got goals and you got wins. LAFC is still the best team in MLS. In my opinion, it is time for the mailbag though. 401-206-0MLS, extra time at MLSsoccer.com. We would love your thoughts on Mauro Minotas and the Houston Dynamo. They did not sell him despite the fact that there were rumors for about $8.5 million from Portugal in for him. It just did not materialize. They didn't play him against Sporting Kansas City. Mauro said, I saw myself over there already. I saw myself in Europe. That's what he told Jesus Acevedo Jr., who does some really great work covering the club for the Bayou Citizens. I didn't say that right.
Whenever I read it, I can't pronounce it, so therefore I didn't try and help you.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. Let me drown. Yamil
Assad. This made me angry. This frustrated me.
I wanted it to get done too. But it sounds like it wasn't on purpose. Sounds like they tried to do it. They held them out against Sporting Kansas City, and it just, for whatever reason, we don't know, didn't materialize the details, whether it be with the player, whether it be with the club. I can't fault them for trying. I would have hoped that they would have sold. They didn't. We'll see what happens.
A good
now.
Old fax machine excuse.
Yeah, probably. They probably.
That's my old school fax machine noise, which I think was better than your alarm. Give me some mail.
I'm going to go here since we talked about it off the top. Mike from South Carolina, thinking of how successful Tyler Miller is, it makes me wonder who are the most successful expansion draft picks in league history. I'd love to get your thoughts. Thanks.
Obviously, Latif's a big one. I think Jack Jewsbury is one that we should think about. Yep. Going to throw that one way back to the Timbers. Captain Jack, he was their captain to start it out, helped establish club culture. He now works for the club in an executive role. So I think that was a pretty darn successful
one. So on the same vein of that one, the guy I looked up who I think was a better player on the field is Sebastian Legette.
Yeah, what are you talking about? Yeah.
I think he's the only player in the Ring of Honor for Philly. He was there multiple times, obviously, was their star attacking player on the field for a number of years, as well as being there. Bobby, who did you want to throw in there?
Brad Evans.
Oh, Brad Evans is good one. Yeah, that is a...
Who were Atlanta's?
That's a great one.
Was Parker's one, or that was a trade?
No, that wasn't. It was like Mikey Ambrose was one of them.
Alec Khan.
They flipped a couple, I think. I don't think they got...
Yeah, they flipped Sean Johnson.
That was a different one. Traded for Sean John, then they flipped him to NYCFC.
If he continues at the same trajectory, the answer will be Latif Blessing.
Yeah, if you've got a better example, which you might, we're just trying to do this off the top of our heads, hit us up. What about the disappointment question? I liked that one.
Okay. Nice. You want to just shift the show yourself?
Yes. End on a dark note.
Okay. Crew SC fan basically emailed us, long email, and he's basically said, who's been the most frustrating team over the last 10 years? Chicago, Orlando, Vancouver, or Columbus?
Can't be Orlando. Take them right off because they won championships in USL and had a great launch. And yeah, it's been frustrating in MLS, but it can't be them. They just don't have the longevity of those other teams.
It can't be Columbus because they went to MLS Cup in 2015.
Yeah.
And
they had great, they've been in the playoffs. They had good years. They've helped blood the future national team coach. Like, it can't be them.
So now we're between Vancouver and Chicago. Unless someone would like to throw another team in there.
Off the top of my head, I'm obsessing over the Fire being that team right now because they've spent money and they haven't done anything and they had so much success previous. So if you look at their like year over year, there's just a lot of DNQs from them since 2009 when they went to the conference finals, and that was they were 4 out of 5 years in the conference finals. They have, let's see here, 6, 7, about to be 8. It'll be 8 out of 10 years DNQ for the playoffs. For a team in Chicago, for a team that has Bastian Schweinsteiger and spent on him in that way, for a team that went out and spent on the likes of Ferrari, smoking cigarettes in the Lamborghini, God, what's his, Nery Castillo. They've spent money. That's what I'm saying. And they had a history of success.
Sean Maloney. I think they were the only team that traded for a DP for a while. They did it with Lundberg and Alvaro Fernandez. Yeah. Like, multiple times they were like, we'll take the retread.
Yeah.
Oh, and I think Gilberto.
Yeah, Gilberto too. Mm. Mm-hmm. And Vancouver fans are sitting there slack-jawed being like, come on, it has got to be us.
Yeah.
It hasn't been great in Vancouver either. But they had some... I mean, they had some, like,
they were fun when they first
mildly
came
okay
in.
Years.
Yeah, but they've
made
never,
the playoffs.
But they've never won anything Chicago has.
Yeah. Yeah. They had the history there.
You guys, I think I get the Nations League thing now.
Really? No, you don't. Nah, you're lying. You're lying. If you get it, hit up Bobby at B Warshaw. Is that right? Yeah. 14. On Twitter.
14.
Forgot he had the number on the end of it. Some of us have played professional soccer. I get it, Bobby. All right, we're out of here. Big thanks to John Arnold. We will be back on Monday to break down U.S.-Mexico and talk U.S.-Uruguay. Join us then, as well as a result from Canada that we hope is a win because we want to see you in the hex. What do you have to
If Canada gets 6 points and you carry the two and then you take the inverted nature of that in the square root,
you square it,
then they make the hex.
That's ELO for you.
If it's cosine.
Yes, exactly. All right, righty, everybody. Have a great weekend.